You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry. This is Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM, and I'm your host, David Gilmore, and we have today Priscilla Long, Ars Longa, Priscilla Longa. You should use the Latin for it, Priscilla. It will rhyme with Priscilla, who is a teacher of writing, has been for a long time, I'm sure. Poet, the books of poetry are a couple of collections that I have. You probably have another one in the works, right?
I have two more in the works.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah. You can name those. I have been reading very carefully poems, that some of which are about Tacoma, which is always good for, if there are any listeners who are devout Tacomans, you're going to hear a couple of poems that are going to knock your socks off. They're very, very close to home. We're going to read poems from Crossing Over, and a fairly new one, Holy Magic, which is full of wonderful color poetry. But Priscilla also writes about art, has written essays about art and inspiration and so on. Minding the Muse, a handbook for painters, composers, writers, and also Dancing with the Muse in Old Age, which is a great inspiration, I think, for anyone who feels that they've got old somewhere in them, that they need to have
or will have
burnished a little bit. Yes.
As I say, the audience for this book and people who must read it, there are two. One is everyone over 40, and the other is everyone under 40.
Welcome to Sound Poetry, Priscilla.
Thank you.
It's going to be lovely to hear your work.
The first book of poems, Crossing Over, has a lot of bridges. And I was reading some of them this morning and realizing they also have colors in them, which is interesting, because Holy Magic is almost about color. Colors are everywhere, and that was part of the point. I organized it according to the color wheel. But Crossing Over, which really is about, well, bridges and crossing over in metaphorical sense, such as crossing to the other side, and it's dedicated to my late sister. And although I realize there's no dedication in it, but it's obvious as you read it. But it also has a lot of colors in it. I'm just becoming aware. So
can't help yourself. That's all there is to it.
Yes, that's the problem. That's the way it always is.
Take us to Tacoma, or you come down to Tacoma with your poem, The Queen of the Cut, to give us the opening of.
Yeah, okay. Now, the Cable Stayed Bridge was built in 1997. It's the new bridge. Of course, now 1997 is a little bit not so new, but I think it's the newest bridge in Tacoma. Bridges don't get built every day. And I have in the notes, of course, we all know this, but actually it turns out that people outside the Northwest don't know that the word cut means it's sort of like a canal, which is interesting. Like, well, what's a cut? You know, what? You don't know? Queen of the Cut. Night gem, sun brooch, sky jewel, a phantom ship, tall masted, cable rigged, Kandinsky bird in blue air. Spear, neat as a girl queen above the cut, Tacoma's quarrel with rust and rotten brick, she reigns, angles of gleams, smoke daughter, penumbra of Mount Tacoma, snow peaks dream her tides, her white piers, she wends her wheel trail through ribbons of light and steel.
Great. And it's so good that you say Mount Tacoma or Tahoma, if you wanted to.
Mount Tacoma.
There's a great deal of controversy. I hope it continues in order to
rename
Mount, right? It's an Aboriginal name that belongs to something closer to home than whoever the Peter Rainier Jr.
Yeah,
was.
I'm not sure he was even ever here or whatever.
Never here at all. But he did fight on the side of the Americans in the Revolutionary
War. Okay, so, but nonetheless.
but he's a real stranger. Never saw the mountain.
Yeah, and such a mountain it is. And then I live in Seattle where it's just spectacular when it comes out. But in Tacoma, it's really spectacular. And right, if you're right past that bridge, it's just amazing to see the bridge and the mountain. It's just amazing.
If you're west of the 11th Street Bridge, you have a look at two bridges as you look over to the mountain. And you mentioned Murray Morgan, too, in the notes.
The Murray Morgan Bridge. I love that bridge. And of course, now I know it's been renovated. So as we know, the Murray Morgan Bridge was the 11th Street Bridge, opened on February 15th, 1913. So it's an old bridge. It was renamed Murray Morgan Bridge in 1997. I know it's been renovated. This poem was written before the renovation. So it's a little rusty in this poem. Memories load. No miracle, this vertical lift, steel truss bridge, its birds, its timbered deck built to bear a load of workers walking to tide flats, horses, carts, old Tacoma streetcars, two towers on piers on piles, pipe water over the lift span, lifting to let pass tugboat, steamship, barge, or bark. And years pass, the truss turns to rust, struts like old bones carry memories load. Murray Morgan tending the lift motor in the lift house, bolted to the lift span, raising and lowering himself, riding skid road through ups and downs. Now falcons roost in the old towers. They swoop and dive, defy geometries of rivet and steel.
Yes, memories load. It is an interesting bridge. I've crossed it many times, sometimes on foot to just go to a, a building on the other side there that's close to it. Mm-hmm. And we used to drive across it to go over the Hylobos Bridge on the other side, but that got closed so much by malfunction that it closed without any more passage across it. So that part of the tide flats got, and the bridge got underused after that time. Mentioning of the Skid Road, the Murray Morgan book, how long ago did he write that?
I just am not able to remember, but Skid Road was the Seattle road that was supposedly logs were skidded down it toward Pioneer Square. But his story is on historylink.org, the online encyclopedia of Washington state history. So if you look at Murray Morgan, you'll find out all kinds of things and a very funny story about him tending the bridge. He was a bridge tender, which there was very little traffic. So actually he was a night bridge tender on the what was called the 11th Street Bridge. So he wrote Skid Road while being a night bridge tender. But there's a very funny story about how one time a boat came and he kind of panicked because he's supposed to raise the bridge. He called emergency and he said, "This is the 11th Street Bridge." And the emergency person said, very funny, and hung up. So that's one of the funny stories of Murray Morgan.
Well, I hope he got it off while the boat came through.
Eventually, he got the thing up. But he had, a perfect job for a writer, being a bridge tender where no boats come through, usually not. I have two here. One is Love Poem. And I want to say how I got this poem, and it's a great exercise for you poets out there, which is you take some prose article about something or pages from a book, but they cannot be poetry. And you circle or make a list of the words you especially like. That's the only criteria. And then you make a poem for those words. So I made this love poem from an article translated from the French by the French philosopher Gaston Bachelard about the masculine and feminine endings of words. It has an epigraph by Bachelard, which is, "We ought to dream more." So this is love poem. Down in the blue depths, words dream among themselves, begin to love. Reveries murmur in vagabond tongues, swell the poppies to fire. What jubilant, gentle work, what bliss for the summer night. Bluebells ding the diphthongs, delight the red depths. Diphthongs tongue their tender bells. Words rub each other, boogie-woogie and bebop, bump and hump in blue drunkenness.
Very loving. Very, 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 very good musical ending that gives a...
And I admit I cheated. Boogie-woogie wasn't in his piece.
But... Oh, dear. But then you needed that. You needed that alliteration, if for nothing else. All the rhyme of boogie-woogie and bebop, yes. Bump and hump in blue drunkenness. Regarding dreams, do you have any connection with reverie and dreams in your poetry? Is there a dream quality that you think of once in a while as a poem has come to you?
I think poems are a kind of dreaming, actually. I am very aware, I'm not sure about dreaming, but we'll talk about colors, but musicality is really, really central to how I think about poetry and how I try to shape a poem. And so if it isn't like really musical, then it needs to, more work.
That's right.
I feel.
And the bluebells don't ding. The diphthongs.
The diphthongs don't ding, then no, we're not there yet. And sometimes it takes quite a while, but I feel the process of working is almost a very dreamlike process. And I know some people, and you know, with good reason, don't think you should revise poetry much. It should come from this deep place. But I feel that revising itself is also coming from this very deep place, which is like a dreaming place. And so how do you know if you're writing a poem, like how do you know when it's done? And you do, because it all clicks together. It's kind of like a whole piece of music. And that's how I think of it, anyhow. I sometimes, you know, you write a poem, you've had a dream in your sleep, and then you write a poem. But I think dreaming has a broader meaning than just when you're sleeping and dreaming. It's kind of like being in a dreamlike state, maybe between your imagination or whatever it is and reality. And it's that state, poetry lives in that place. So yeah, that's how I think of it.
Yes. Well, when you do edit or revise a poem, you still got to go from this sort of conscious now reality to go deeply into that place that the poem has been seated in, embedded in.
Yes, and it's a place of the imagination where we go to. And it's also true in reading poetry. We are going into, it's like going into a room or going into a place or a world that isn't in the same, you know, living room or cafe that you're sitting in. It's another place. And in working the poem, you know, needs to keep drawing you in and in. And then I work on lines a lot. I love the poetic line, and I feel that if a line is kind of prosy or gray, speaking of colors, gray prose, then no, it needs to do something more. No. So
yes, but then if you use gray, it would be for a special meaning, wouldn't it?
That's right.
And you're going to compose a poem in to compose a poem.
Oh, yes. Okay. So here's to compose a poem. And it's also in the book Crossing Over. To compose a poem. Follow with your fingers the hollows and hills of letters. Follow their curves to their peaks and gurgling wells. Keep your fingers feeling the dips and downs, the hills and dales of letters themselves. Follow the fat, loop the skin of the letters themselves. Feel how words bump, ding, dip, and bop across the slippery silk. Feel how they rush into whiteness. Dip your fingers into their furrows, into their indigo blood. Feel how they want to whisper the page. Feel them curl to the kiss of the page.
How you followed Love Poem with that one is quite interesting, where you continue the bebop music and the bump. And the bump, don't forget the bump here.
That's
and
right.
The ding, and the dip, which are, and across the slippery silk. So, yeah, there's a good feeling that you love the words. You have a sort of erotic connection with the words that you play with. Mm-hmm. And feeling that you kiss the page as you're working. Not literally, of course, but yeah. Mm-hmm. And you follow with your fingers. Yes, and we do. So how a person often reads, following a line with the kinetic movement of the eye and the finger.
And it's a corporal, it's also in the body, in several ways, like the rhythm is, it's our heartbeat and it's in the body and the fingers and the feel. Just the feel of it, dipping fingers into their furrows, into their indigo blood. Feel in the whisper and curl.
Yes. Well, you're going, this is a perfect one also to move on into the magic of the color, with especially the indigo and the whiteness, of course, is there. But I think that we've also been blued quite a bit, haven't we? We've been blue, with bluebells. Yeah,
this is not the color book.
But this isn't the color book, but it gives us a great introduction to Holy Magic. And the cover of Holy Magic, is that any special place? It looks like a performance.
Yes, I read for many years with the Seattle 5+1. We had a great time. We practiced. We still work together, but we haven't performed together for a while. But in any case, this is a studio in Georgetown. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to give you the name, but it's a guy has made these old warehouses in Georgetown into artist studios, and they have an open night, and this was a performance space. It looks kind of very gritty and it was a performance space that we performed one night. It was great fun.
It looks like a place where it was for opening many doors, although the kind of layered on top of one, and maybe he gave them away. Choose a door now. Which door do you choose?
Go through this door. Whatever is beyond that, you will discover.
Yes.
Yeah.
You'll see the stage on Holy Magic. It's quite a funky looking environment, especially good for poetry too. It looks like me.
That's right. That's right.
So we're going to start with Matisse's Radiance, which, as I was saying this morning, I've been looking at his famous jazz book of his cutouts with brush-written lettering in it. Mm-hmm. And it's very beautiful altogether, compositions.
Since I discovered him probably when I was 14 or something, I've always loved Matisse, and the more I learn about him, I mean, he was painting during the war, and actually, I think during the occupation of France, this is World War II, of course, he was painting these beautiful things. And I think, and people can say, oh, see, he was kind of ignoring the important things. But I think he was saying beauty is still here. During hard times, beauty is still here. And yes. So Matisse's Radiance, and it has an epigraph by Matisse, love is a great thing, a great goodness. London in flames, corpse smoke in the street, 1942. Matisse in Paris paints dancer in blue tutu, retreats to retinal red fish, his blue bathers blind to war. The world in war yearns toward evening light. Somewhere someone pours tea. Later, wheelchair bound, the painter wields scissors to make orange suns, blue ivy, tender purple jazz.
Yes, there's famous cutouts.
Yeah, yeah.
And you start with London. So when you get to someone pours tea, it's almost the same. My neighbor's over there. Someone's pouring a cup of tea.
That's so, right.
But I'm over here doing blue tutus.
Bombs and, are falling, but
right. Oh, it's a blue time, all right. Yeah, all right. Whatever one can get out of blueness, I'm sure it's there during war times. The world in war yearns towards evening light, which of course is an indigo darkness sometimes that. Gives you the idea that it's time for tea. Now you're going on with not so much blue, but well, we're going to get blue again, I'm sure. You can't avoid blue, but we're getting into darker blue.
Indigo.
Different blues, yes.
Indigo. Early morning light, it's sometimes of year, it is indigo. When it's not light yet, but it's not sunrise, but it's before sunrise, it's indigo. Often. Anyway, this is indigo and violet. And this poem has two quotes in it. If you saw it in the page, they would be in italics. One is from Say Shonagon, the pillow book, and one is from Robert Bringhurst, Everywhere Being is Dancing, and it ends with a quote from him. So indigo and violet. Indigo's deep black before dawn. Violet's an evening song. Indigo's X is silver. Violet's obsidian. Indigo is bluish black glowing. Violet is pale, grape-colored figured silk. Indigo's the color of night, lapis, lost love. Violet is frothy, scarves and jewels, glints of sea light. Indigo's indigenous, indignant. Violet floats and flirts. Indigo plays cello, adagio. Violet, the viola. And so it goes, the dance at the heart of being.
You write about the violet. I read Eliot's Wasteland with some men in honoring his centenary of that poem a few months ago, last year. And you know the famous line in there, when the carbuncular man comes to the lady in the apartment who is the typist, it's the great seer Tiresias that says, at the violet hour. Now he says at the violet hour, but that's once. Later on, five verses later, he says, at the violet hour. And he loved that idea of this mysterious coloration, of the early evening.
Yeah.
A mysterious color of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And You have really dug into that one and given us an exposure.
Colors are, you know, they're very powerful in terms of associations. What they might be different for different people. They might have different effects. Although things like, you know, red is danger. In China, red is happiness. But it's whatever it is, it's very strong. It's a very strong color. And if you want to be freaked out in the Seattle Public Library downtown, you might have seen the Red Room, and it's completely red. And I've heard it said that when people freak out in the library, they are more often than not, they're freaking out in the Red Room. So just keep the Red Room. But the point is, whether or not we're aware, they affect us.
Yes. The way also you sneak in some foreshadowings of colors that are going to come, lapis, mm-hmm. the one word. You don't mention the full term for, but lapis is enough. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the writer who did an essay in a poetry magazine of 10 years ago says in the essay, color is not simply a decorative element in a poem. Color creates an expanse, a field, a shared formal field with which to plant more shared components of the material imagination, a poem. Color makes this space bigger, this imaginative space more specific and bigger, gives it weight, makes it solid.
Yes. Yeah. And I totally concur with that. As Rem Koolhaas in the library, he actually makes a space which is a color. It's a very interesting conjunction. But without being in the Red Room, it creates moods. I wouldn't say it creates emotions, but it brings up emotions. People with synesthesia, which I've always envied, you know, because I don't have it, but think of letters as having certain colors and numbers, you know, number one will be, you know, blue, and number three will be yellow. And I always envy those people, but I don't have that. But it's true that color is everywhere. And the other interesting thing about this article that you're talking about is it talks about the space between reality and dream. And color really is that space, because there is no color out in the world. There are light waves bouncing off of everything. These are not colors. They don't become colors until they hit our retina and they hit our cones and they turn into electrical impulses, go all the way back to the occipital lobe and then all the way back to the front. And then that's when we see the color purple, and not before. It is does not exist out in the world. So it is kind of a transitional space.
Uh-huh.
Between reality and the dream world or the imagination.
Right. Particles are flying. Particles are flying in frequencies. And of course, it is paint often, or a paper with paint color on it, which gives it a particular matter, right?
It's the things that are rejected by this surface are bounced back. And that's what, so if something rejects the light wave that is red, that what light wave is bounced back and the thing appears red. Well, it has rejected red. That's why it appears red.
Right. And you know, when you look at those jazz images of the cutouts of Matisse, the density of them is incredible on the page. If you get it in a large format, it just overwhelms you, the combination of a great blue shape and a very blue, so blue shape. Stunning combinations of dense color, yeah.
And see, in poetry, you can kind of do the same thing. I mean, I'm not saying we can all be Matisse, but I'm saying if you put blue and orange, the words blue and orange together in a poem, they become a visual blue and orange, whatever, in your mind. So you can play with colors that way.
You wrote a poem particularly about orange. Orange is the word that appears several times in the Ghazal, I think, that you have in the early part of it. That one, I think, is so suffused with the color of orange.
A Ghazal in orange. This dream, your face turns orange. Your red hair burns orange. Matisse floats in liquid blue lucidity. His red studio yearns for orange. Bombs flame red. A pre-war photo, all dolls and smiles, turns orange. Purple desires blue. Blue wants black and blue. Dragon's blood spurns orange. I'm a red-faced girl in October, long ago, watching elms learn orange.
Yes, you can taste that one almost. It's a very tasty ghazal. Yeah, and you know, the orange, I have come across the word so many times since reading your ghazal. This is the way poetry works often for people that are looking for connections or resonances anyway. I have seen orange in so many prose writings, or I've heard it spoken by somebody, and I think, there it goes again. There's the orange, and it's very different from the other orange, because this one is an orange sweat outfit. And I think, that's an interesting one. What would be the reason for an orange sweatsuit? Well, not a very happy situation in a lot of places when you're wearing one of them.
Yeah.
And so it can take on, there's beauty in that color, but when it's connected to something that has to do with imprisonment,
right,
incarceration,
then
Orange is the New Black. Wasn't that the name of a series?
Yes, I think so. I don't think I've seen it, but yeah. Yes. And that's true of colors. Like, okay, let me tell you a story. I was once engaged, and we were married for 20 years. Now we're divorced. We're good friends still. We've been divorced as long as we were married, which was 20 years or so. Well, he was a draft resister. And so I would visit him in prison. And this is Vietnam days. And all the prisons, for whatever reason, they were painted this particular shade of sort of palish green. I have always wanted to throw up every time I've seen that green. It might be a pretty color, but it is I call it prison green. And maybe they're not, associations are very strong with colors. Marie Antoinette, yeah. And when everyone was starving around her, and she's supposed to be the queen, you know, to do something about this, and instead she loved the color puce and had many gowns made, and so yeah, that's the color puce. It's kind of
it's really great to talk about color, just as color, whatever imagery comes to mind. It's not necessarily from something real and colorful before a person, but the word itself does a great job in transmitting the frequency. Yeah.
Somebody said, I think, I always forget whether it was Kandinsky or Goethe, because they both wrote a lot about color, but somebody said, blue is low and yellow, you never think of yellow as being low, it's high. Now, of course, there are cultural differences with all of this, you know, so just keep that in mind, but
brighten us up with the lantern.
Oh, the lantern. Oh, okay. Lantern. Lantern has an epigraph from the Rig Veda. Let us have a good fire and be beloved. Reading in the kitchen, yellow potatoes boil. The pages are yellow, an old story in an old storybook. A gnome, a pigtail girl talking to her teddy bear. It is night. The moon is yellow. A wood stove burns a birch log, bakes biscuits. In this yellow light, being is well-being, and all is well.
That's good. You transform yellow into something very healthy. I've been your host, David Gilmore, with poet and teacher and wise writer, Priscilla Long.